You're listening to episode 339 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in, oh my gosh, where am I? I'm somewhere in Pennsylvania. Newtown Square, Pennsylvania.
He's right around the corner from me, and I didn't even know it, folks. And this is David from Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. How are we, Max? Evidently, you're traveling like you do quite often these days.
I am, and for some reason, I'm losing my voice. If I sound funny, it's because, well, I am funny, but besides that, I'm losing my voice for some reason. I don't know, David. You may have to do almost all the talking.
Okay, well, we better get started then.
Okay.
We got a lot of topics to talk about, or evidently I have a lot of topics to talk about. Airfield design guidelines for large UAS, a guidebook for UAS threats at airports, and Airbus Naval UAS conducts its first free flight. For the conservation segment, studying sea turtles and saving baby deer, how to fully charge a drone in 5 minutes or less, and that doesn't require a fuel cell. And probably one of the longest articles I've ever read, which was drones are flying over nuclear power plants. And a lot of people aren't happy about it. Well, our first story comes this week from AJOT.com. Wolpert hired to research and develop airfield design guidelines for large UAS. Max, it's an infrastructure, airport infrastructure thing. My father would be so proud. Basically, UASs have to operate in the same environment as normal aircraft, and that includes around airports and on runways and taxiways. So here we have a story from Wolpert, and they call themselves an architecture, engineering, geospatial, and strategic consulting firm. And they are looking to see how manned and unmanned aircraft are going to operate in the same airspace, or in this case, ground space.
Yeah, usually we're talking about drones encroaching on airport property and causing problems. But this is kind of the whole thing flipped around, I guess, David. This is airports looking ahead at the assumption that large UAS may be part of what airports do, right? Not only might they be sharing the airspace, but large UAS may be using airports as their airfield. So the question is, what should airport managers be thinking about? What should planners, engineers, and even UAS operators be thinking about if manned and unmanned aircraft are going to be operating in the airspace? And there may be some facility changes required at the airport in order to accommodate these things. So I think it's good, David, because it's an example of looking ahead.
I'm kind of fond of it being, you know, if people don't know, my father was a base civil engineer, so I learned a lot about concrete and runways and parking spots and hangars. And all of that infrastructure has to be built to support new aircraft. Things like a military base, in my father's case, or a normal civilian airport, they have ramps that are set up for specs. In the aviation industry, one of the things was the A380. When it came online, there was a whole lot of changes to airports that needed to accommodate them. They needed larger taxiways. They needed larger gates, you know, bigger tugs. And in this case, they have to look at what electric UASs are going to do. What's the charging system going to be like? You know, what's de-icing going to be like for this stuff? And other things like environmental noise, communication, fire and rescue support, navigation concerns, surface infrastructure support, facilities, power and battery support. All of this stuff is something you need to think about to integrate an aircraft into the UAS, which is the airspace system, but in this case, we're talking about an airport airspace system.
And Wolpert is developing these guidelines under what's called an Airport Cooperative Research Program, an ACRP. That's something it's actually managed by the Transportation Research Board of the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, and it's sponsored by the FAA. So this is not just a consulting firm off looking for something to do on their own. This is something that has a lot of structure to it and is part of a larger airport program. So it has that credibility. I didn't see in the article, David, any indication of when these guidelines would be developed. Maybe I just missed them. I don't know.
I think it's basically a preliminary. I don't think there was a deadline yet set. We'll keep an eye open for it. It's a very interesting aspect and kind of forward thinking because it is NETS goes back to the FAA, but delivery by drone, I know that, you know, FedEx is going to want to operate their drones or UPS or U.S. Postal Service next to their terminals where they're unloading other aircraft like 767s or 777s. So that all of that is going to be very important. But Wolpert is also got into part of the National Safe Skies Alliance to develop UAS response guidebook for airports. The guidebook is intended to help plan and respond to UAS threats. So, Max, what's the National Safe Skies Alliance?
It's a nonprofit organization. Here again, it's funded by the FAA and the National Safe Skies Alliance. Sometimes it's just called Safe Skies. They work with airports and government as well as with industry, and they're looking to maintain a safe and effective aviation security system. So they've contracted again with Wolpert on a different study.
And, you know, it's kind of a parallel study because it affects the same group of individuals, sort of. And that's to develop strategies for planning, identification, and threat assessment, response, and recovery. They'll look into detection system considerations and legal and public policy and regulatory considerations, provide relevant examples and case studies, and prepare a plan for community awareness and prevention. For every UAS program, there's a counter-UAS program. And UAS is operating in the airspace of an airport. You need to be able to determine if it's a friend or a foe or a threat. You know, interesting that that's part of the infrastructure you're going to need at an airport. So they're going to conduct a literature and data review. They're going to utilize an advisory board and project panel with representation from airport operators, airport law enforcement, the FAA, and the TSA. And the production is already underway and a completion is planned for 2021. So they're really working on the ground game for the UASs, it sounds like, Max.
As it applies to airport and airport operations. So, yeah, that's good. And like I say, forward-looking, and that's always good.
Our next story comes from avweb.com. Airbus UAV Halo completes first free flight. Airbus Helicopters VSR 700 is a multi-mission naval UAS, and it's designed to operate alongside other shipboard naval assets. Provides commanders with a larger and clearer tactical picture. Airbus says it multiplies search and rescue power and offers a capable autonomous platform. The VSR 700 is a smaller helicopter. It's kind of like what the Navy did with the Jet Ranger to make it a larger operating, taking a manned helicopter and making it an unmanned vehicle. And with all that extra space you have for things like sensors and inputs, et cetera, because you're not carrying passengers.
So this first free flight was conducted in France at a drone center there. It flew just 10 minutes, and they flew it within visual line of sight. Previously, it had only been flown tethered. In fact, I think last November was the previous tethered flight. So this is the first free flight, as I said, just 10 minutes. Like I say, David, it's not an enormous copter by any means. Power comes from a Continental CD155 four-cylinder engine. That's a FADEC-controlled turbo diesel. It runs on Jet A. and they are looking for sea trials towards the end of next year, 2021.
And here I thought you were going to get all excited about the term FedEx showing up in a news thing, but you can't talk to talk about it.
Yeah, FedEx. FedEx is a full authority digital electronic, no, I think digital engine control. It's basically the computer that controls the engine, and it's programmable and adjustable typically. You find the same thing in commercial airliners as well. But you sort of manage your engine through that. It's sort of a advanced concept. Maybe not so advanced these days because they're so common, but when they first came out, it was pretty hot stuff. It's a pretty advanced little four-cylinder engine.
So good for Airbus. I guess I really included this in the show notes to show that, you know, even the big boys are still playing in the field. You know, Boeing and Airbus are still moving forward, even though the rest of their industries are sort of crashing or crumbling around them because of the pandemic. But it's interesting that Airbus is definitely following through with this. And there's a market for ship-based aerial reconnaissance. And when we talk about ship-based, we're talking about frigates and cruisers, you know, and destroyers, not the big capital ships. So, I mean, a small helicopter like this would be great to use off of a frigate. And there's a lot of countries out there that would want that ability. So, all right. Well, the next episode is This Week in Conservation. Two good stories. One about turtles and the other one about
deer, baby deer, Bambis.
Bambis. Yeah. So our first story is from UAS Vision. Embry-Riddle and Northrop Grumman survey sea turtles. Turtle Tech Project teams Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, or URAU, and Northrop Grumman with the Brevard Zoo in Florida. It's a drone-based surveillance effort to better understand sea turtle behavior. Now, I don't think they're going to get the hit that Australia had with that video a couple of weeks ago where there were thousands of them. But their computer visioning systems can identify individual sea turtles as well as their species, gender, and unique markings. And this is funded by Northrop Grumman.
Yeah, grant from the foundation there. So Embry-Riddle plans to use two different types of unmanned aircraft. One is a fixed-wing VTOL, that's the Applied Aeronautics Albatross, and the advantage there is it's got long flight times. And the other is a DJI Matrice 210, and that's able to carry multiple payloads, and it also has the sensors that can capture finer-grain images. I guess they expect to be flying both of these altitudes of around 200 or 300 feet, which should be high enough not to disturb the sea turtles.
So the students will have a hands-on opportunity to work on flight operations, aircraft modifications, and payload integration, otherwise known as STEM, and will use a neural network for data analysis. So just some interesting things is most species of sea turtles are endangered, and sea turtles may lay 100 or more eggs in each nest, but only 1 in 1,000 to 10,000 hatchlings will reach adulthood. So that's why there's always such a conservation when the hatchlings pop up to get them into the ocean. They have a better chance of surviving.
Right.
And that's why we're talking about babies. But let's go to the other end of the mammal spectrum. And that's talking from DroneDJ.com. A thermal drone used to save 15 baby deer in Norway. What do drones do? They're really good at finding things in the dark.
Hmm. Yeah, this is a story about a particular wildlife and outfield manager in Norway. And he has been using a thermal camera on a drone. And every morning he flies this between 2 a.m. and 6:30 a.m., I guess he's an early riser. And what he does is he's looking for injured baby deer in grasslands. And I think, as it mentions in the article, the reason for the nighttime surveying is that there's greater contrast between the deer and their environment. So it makes it easier for them to spot the baby deer.
Not to mention they are kind of nocturnal and they do like that time of day. Unlike the rest of us, you couldn't give me enough coffee to get up at 3 a.m. to go hunt deer. The drone is a Mavic 2 Enterprise Dual equipped with both thermal cameras and visual cameras. They're only flying at about 75 feet off the ground.
73 feet.
It flies about 73 feet off the ground. What's interesting is that's pretty low considering you're flying on edges of woods and stuff. So I got to give the guys some credit for flight skills too. And when a deer is spotted, a volunteer goes to investigate. So they go and help the baby deer and the deer go back out to mommy, and we don't have the tragedy that you get from watching Bambi.
Well, David, I had two questions after looking at this article. The first one is, why 73 feet? I mean, my first thought was, okay, maybe that translates from some round number in metric or something, you know, meters, but it doesn't. So I don't know. I don't know why 73 feet. It just seems like an odd altitude.
It's probably the height of the tree line that they're the average height of the tree line for the deer. I did round it up to 75 because 73 just didn't sound right. But so what was your other question, Max?
So he's saved 15 baby deer. He says, or it says that these are injured baby deer. What is injuring all these deer? All these baby deer. That's a lot of, that's a lot of baby deer in a relatively short period of time. I'm just wondering.
They've got fragile little bones, Max. You know, they might break a leg. They might run into a tree. You know, mom might stomp on them. And there are other things that like deer, like bears. And so, I mean, besides the fact that deer like things like automobiles, or they like being in the way of automobiles. If anybody's ever had a deer hit a car like I have, believe me, it's one of the most traumatic experiences I've ever had, and you should see what it does to a C-130. But, you know, it's a good story, Max. It's 15 deer that get to grow up to be bucks and does, you know, and maybe since it's north, maybe they're reindeer and Santa Claus is going to be able to use them for package delivery or, you know, remote delivery.
And I take it this is a project from volunteers. And I understand that if you are interested in helping out with this, like with your drone, and you live in Norway, that I think they're interested in getting more volunteers. So if that's something you would like to do and can do, be sure to check out the article in the show notes. I think that'll give you some leads as to how to get in touch with this effort.
And pack a parka.
Yes.
It's, you know, thinking Norway in the low 40s probably feels really good to both of us, Max, in this current weather.
It sure does.
StoreDot demonstrates the world's first 5-minute charge of a commercial drone. This was from UAS Weekly.com. StoreDot is a battery developer that specializes ultra-fast charging, UFC, technology. They previously proposed applying UFC tech to electric vehicles and mobile phone power banks. Now the company is applying UFC technology to the drone industry. They've demonstrated fully charging a commercial drone in 5 minutes. That's pretty awesome, Max. What do you think?
I think that has a lot of very interesting implications because that's, you know, multiples faster than would typically be the case in recharging a commercial drone battery. So if you can charge with that speed, that just has some real positive implications. Now, StoreDot says that these lithium-ion batteries that they've developed are, quote, based on novel nanostructured materials combined with proprietary organic binders and enhanced electrolytes. Wow.
You know, Max, I love it when you talk dirty to me like that.
I know. They call this the flash battery technology. They also say that the production is scalable and can utilize existing manufacturing facilities with only minor modifications. A big part of this is the battery itself, which is different. And they have a lot of patents for it. They say on their website that they have been granted 31 patents, and they have another 51 that are pending.
82 patents for one battery is pretty impressive. But how does it work? Well, the anode is coated in layered nanoparticles and embedded in an organic conductive matrix. This is really sounding very matrixy, right? The cathode uses proprietary compounds for enhanced stability and safety. Now, that's really important, Max, because how many times have we talked about LiPo batteries burning down 787s? And fast charging means you also have to be safe with the thing. The electrolyte has high voltage capability and enhanced safety with dendrite prevention. This is jargon that just amazes me. The cell structure uses thin layer coating, which is optimized for ultra-fast charging in a thermal management. And the electronics use dynamic charging profiles with real-time voltage management. I guess, Max, that means you can see it charging and you know where exactly it is in real time?
Well, there's monitoring, but there's also controlling. And for these types of batteries and lithium ion batteries in general, that battery, that charging system has a lot of electronics in it to monitor the charging rates and so forth, the temperatures, things like that. There are usually like charging profiles. So it's not just apply a charge and when it's full, turn the charger off. There are actually different cycles, different phases of the charging process that are handled differently. And so the electronics that controls all of that is really, really important. So, so this sounds pretty optimistic. Of course, it is proprietary. I don't recall any competing technologies that provide the same performance level. So, you're talking proprietary, but StoreDot is looking to provide both the battery and the charging station that's required for it. So it would have to be a complete package, the two components, the battery and the charging station. If this proves as good as it sounds, I think this is pretty important.
It could be game-changing technology, and I really hate that phrase. But batteries, Max, we've talked about a lot. If the number one weakness for drones is the FAA, the probably close behind it would be battery life, and battery weight. And, what I'm kind of curious is, does the fast charge of the battery limit the life of the battery? We've all experienced our iPhones dying after a year or so because they start losing they lose their quote memory. I'm wondering what the lifespan is for these batteries, taking 5 minutes to charge if you're only going to get maybe 50 flights out of it might not be realistic, but I guess that's one of the challenges that they need to continue to overcome.
So, David, at the beginning of the show, you mentioned that one of the articles we have is probably the longest article you've ever read, and I will have to confirm that this really, really is a long, detailed article, but it's pretty interesting.
It definitely is a long read, but I was very intrigued by it. It kind of dovetails off of our UFOs flying around the Northwest that nobody knows, but this was from thedrive.com again. The night a mysterious drone swarm descended on the Palo Verde nuclear power plant. Yeah, that does sound menacing, and in a way it really is uncomfortable that we have sort of a swarm of drones approaching a nuclear power plant, one of the largest in here in the United States. And they didn't know where they came from. They didn't know what their threats were. And most of all, they weren't really sure what to do.
Mm. And it happened twice. This goes back to September 2019 when this occurred. And it was at night, two successive evenings, a swarm of drones appeared in Arizona, as you said, over the Palo Verde Nuclear Generation Station, which is described as America's most powerful nuclear plant. And we get some information, again, we talked about this last week, I think, from some Freedom of Information Act obtained documents. And one of the most humorous parts of it all, I think, or maybe the only funny part about this, is the characterization that this event was given by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC. They called it a dronapalooza. It's not a very technical term.
Well, but, you know, it's sort of, it's a pop-up drone party. The FOIA requests from the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, or the CISA, resulted in 32 pages of documents, but the CISA refused to release them, citing exemptions related to law enforcement activities. There were 17 pages of relevant records still undergoing review by the TSA. But what are we talking about? One, the acting security section chief at the plant reported that a number of drones were flying over and around the restricted area near the nuclear power plant's Unit 3. Now, folks, we've told you 100,000 times, don't go flying over nuclear power plants. They're a no-fly zone. I like this term. The headquarters emergency response officer, otherwise known as the HERO, created an incident report in the NRC's Security Information Database, or SID. The report said five or six drones were flying over the site at an estimated altitude of 200 to 300 feet. Officers believed the drones were over 2 feet in diameter. Drones had spotlights which were turned off as they approached and lingered almost an hour. Now, six drones, you're talking a minimum of six people. I don't know of any consumer or prosumer drones that can be flown tag team by one controller.
Yeah, or was it just some guy on a lark? I can imagine one idiot flying his one drone over the nuclear reactor to see what's going on, but a swarm of them, five or six of them, that just doesn't sound like somebody that was just goofing off would do. I mean, it almost, to me anyway, suggests there is something, maybe more sinister going on here. And they hung around for an hour, but this is the first night.
And that's even gets scarier because when you're doing a threat assessment or something, a lot of times you do one threat and then you do another one to learn what, if anything, they learned from your first attack. So the next night, four drones were observed. They flew in through and around the owner-controlled area, the security-owned controlled area, and a protected area. Described as large with red and white flashing lights, spotlights were not noted. So again, they repeated the process with maybe not so many drones, but it is kind of frightening that, again, there really wasn't any sort of defense set up.
Well, yeah, and there also wasn't any understanding of what could be done. I mean, it seems like the consensus was, well, there isn't much we can do. You know, there are aircraft and they're flying around. Yeah, they're not supposed to be there, but we can't do anything. There was one, I don't know if he was an officer, but when they were reporting these things at night, and this was in the middle of the night, you know, they woke up this security officer to report these, who, as described in the article here, got to the point where he was saying, effectively, look, we can't do anything about it, so let's not keep waking me up in the middle of the night for something that we can't do anything about. So that strikes you as being a kind of an interesting response to, you know, what might be a serious threat. I mean, it might be just
It is a unique threat assessment.
Yeah.
The wake up value. If anyone's seen Dr. Strangelove, you'll know that, you know, some generals do not like to be interrupted, even in case of a major threat.
Yeah.
And the article does go into threat analysis on small prosumer and consumer drones, that they are a high, easily accessible threat. You know, drones aren't just predators and reapers anymore, but off-the-shelf ones are quite capable of carrying, say, 10 pounds, and that's a pretty large grenade or a improvised explosive device, you know. And for $100, you can fly that to a target and kamikaze it and do some serious damage. The Marine General Kenneth McKenzie, who's the head of the U.S. Central Command, is quoted in the article as saying, quote, "I argue all the time with my Air Force friends that the future of flight is vertical and is unmanned. I'm not talking about large unmanned platforms, which are size of a conventional fighter jet that we can see and deal with as we would any other platform. I'm talking about the one you can go out and buy at Costco right now in the United States for $1,000. Four quad rotorcraft or something like it that can be launched and flown, and with very simple modifications can be made into something that can drop a weapon like a hand grenade or something else. It's really kind of a scary threat, which is why counter UAS is really important."
Well, the military is struggling with this. Airports are struggling with this. Everybody's struggling with, you know, how we respond to a threat that could come from some kid down the street.
Anywhere.
Or some, you know, an adversarial government or some other kind of force.
Or the state of Connecticut.
Or the residents of Connecticut.
Or the residents of Connecticut. But I would recommend everyone to take time and read this article. It's well written, well documented, and it's a very interesting case study of what to do, what not to do, what we don't know what to do. We're only one couple of steps away from somebody else doing this and repeating the process. So we have to get on board. And again, I mean, this is sort of part of the your grounded files, but we don't really know who to ground. But fly safe, you know, and hopefully that way it'll be easier to find the bad guys when they do something like this.
All right. Well, let's wrap it up, David. I want to thank you all for listening to episode 339 of the UAV Digest. Find us at theuavdigest.com. If you want to go to the show notes, and we've got some great articles for you to take a look at, that's at theuavdigest.com/339.
And of course, you can find us scouring the globe on social media. You can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/UAV Digest. You can find us on our Slack listener team talking about drones and airplanes and Formula One race cars and other things that you want to geek out about. And you do that by sending us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. Thanks to everyone who sent us feedback over the last couple of weeks. And we do read everything. Sometimes we forget to put them in the show notes. But we like you. We look forward to seeing you next week. So with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And this is Max in Newtown Square, Pennsylvania.
Close to the American Helicopter Museum. Thanks for listening.